All right. Hey, everyone, and welcome to Gentle Healing 3. It's good to see you all. I never know what to say next. You know, we always get on a roll, but I never know what to say coming into Gentle Healing 3. I guess my first question is, do any of y'all have anything that you want to share? Tuan, do you want to say something? Wait, you're still muted. Okay, good, good, go.
Okay. I want to apologize for falling asleep last week. I get up very early. I get up at 4 in the morning. So sometimes I doze off. When I woke up, everybody was gone. So I just want to say I'm sorry, to the group that I fell asleep, and I'm going to try and stay awake tonight.
Are you on the East Coast?
Yes.
Yeah, see, we're late there, so I understand. You know what? If I was in your shoes, I'd fall asleep too. I get up at 5 and go to bed at 9. So I totally get it.
I get up at 4, so, I have the same bedtime as my grandchildren. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and no apologies necessary. I totally understand. Like I said, I would have done the same thing. Okay. If I was in the East Coast. It's nicer. You need to move to Colorado. The hours are a little nicer.
Yeah, they are. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else have anything they want to share? All right, then, I will dive into my collection. And as you guys know, jump in at any time, right? That's how we play this game. So the first thing I have to look at is quotes 249 and 250. Says, "Is there a greater folly than the aching folly of supposing that the self, the eye of pure awareness, which does not see this changing world at all, is subject to some change?" And the reason I selected this quote was the "does not see this changing world at all." And you'll see why in a moment. But for now, let me go on to 250. "Pure being, our self nature, that alone exists eternally. Apart from that, all objects we perceive are clusters of elusive appearances that come and go, while that unmoving and unchanged abides the same forever." And I really picked this quote primarily because of the fact that it says that alone exists. So we have quote 249, which says that the self does not see this changing world at all. And then quote 250 says that the self alone exists. And what I want to do with y'all, I mentioned last week Bernadette Roberts. I want to read a little bit from one of her books. This one is called What is Self? What is Self? And you'll hear how she hits on those points. But the difference is she's talking from her direct experience, right? So looks like I wanted to read first from page 167. I actually took the time to go find the parts I wanted to read. On page 67, she says, "If the truth be known, the only permanent, eternal, and unbroken high man will ever experience is not in this world. For such a condition is what heaven is. In this final heavenly estate, the world is neither seen nor heard. For heaven is that which man has never seen nor heard." And this is very much like some of the quotes we've seen that says, you know, either you get this world or you get that world, but you can't have both worlds, right? She's saying the same thing, that the heavenly state, in the heavenly state, the world is neither seen nor heard, and man has ever never seen nor heard this heavenly state or this eternal state. Then the next thing I wanted to look at was pages 178 to 187. And again, she's talking from her personal experience. I'm only going to read the parts that I underlined or else it would take too long. So I'll be skipping around a little bit. She says, there were moments when I knew and even saw that in some unknowable way, all sense of self was dying. The sense of dying was not on the level of the phenomenal self, but on the deepest unitive level of being or life. And if you've seen that Dr. David Hawkins video that I've showed a few times, you know, he talks about how he had surrendered everything. And the only thing he hadn't surrendered was life itself. Do you remember that? And so he surrendered life itself. And that's what came to his awakening. And I really think it's important to hear people when they talk about these things, because they're describing what it feels like. You know, we can talk about letting go of the false self. And we can talk about, you know, we might imagine that I'm letting go of my values. I'm letting go of the idea that I'm Regina. But what they're talking about is actually more intense and experience than that. They're talking about letting go what you think is life, you know, what you think is beingness. So she says, this sense of dying was not on the level of phenomenal self, but on the deepest unitive level of being or life. We seem to lose the habit of considering ourselves at all. These are the years of egoless living. We are no longer mindful of having any experience of life to call our own. Thus, when we suddenly try to have a concern for ourselves, it will not work. It has become impossible. There is no self there anymore to be concerned. It is as if the deepest sense of self had just gradually faded away before we knew it was gone. All that is left of us is basically what other people see. Also, I noticed that at times when a situation arose that would have evoked some spontaneous interior response, an energy or feeling, there would be no such movement at all. No response forthcoming. It seems that after years of literally giving ourselves away, retaining nothing and not protecting ourselves, we come to a point where life can go right on without all those responses of the phenomenal self. So what she's talking about here, because I am skipping a little bit, here she's talking about what led up to this final death. So prior to the final death, there were several years of gradually letting go of the self, you know, gradually surrendering, gradually caring more for others than for the self, you know, losing the selfishness. And so you come to this point where it seems there's very little self left. And again, this is exactly what Dr. David Hawkins said. He said he had surrendered everything. The only thing left to surrender was life itself. And she seems to be describing the same thing. Like there's very little self at all because everything has been given away. But yet she's experiencing this sense of dying, right? Like life itself now is going to go. She says the divine flame was gradually consuming the self from the center outward. And with every major selfless act, a chunk of the deepest unknown self would fall away and disappear into this flame. Having come so far in the journey, however, and having trusted God through thick and thin for 40 years, there was nothing left that could shake or move an unquestioned trust. And I think this is very, very important too, because again, first of all, notice she said 40 years, right? 40 years she's been letting go of the self. But notice that she says in that 40-year time frame, what she learned was just to trust God or trust consciousness or to trust the universe implicitly. You know, there were a number of times when she was asked to let go of something, some decision or some responsibility or some control, and there was an inner panic, just like we all feel inner panics, and she would let go anyway. And what she learned through that process of letting go, letting go, letting go, or surrendering, 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 was that everything was always taken care of, right? That she didn't have to control. And so what she developed through that process, in addition to less and less and less self, was more and more and more trust. And if you know NTI 1 Corinthians, NTI 1 Corinthians talks about becoming the empty shell. And it says the only thing the empty shell should hold to is trust. And you can imagine that if you're coming to this point where the only thing left to surrender is life itself, as Dr. David Hawkins said, you're going to need a heck of a lot of trust to take that step, right? So this process that we go through of gradually letting go of ourselves through surrender, or through, she calls it, selfless acts, again, does two things. It takes the self down, less and less and less self, and it increases the trust. So it's really preparing us for this final step or this final doorway. She says, if we have not first experienced or lived all these responses, then of course we cannot live without them. We cannot go beyond anything we have not experienced or known in the first place. But when life's problems become nothing but sheer repetition, they no longer provide the slightest challenge, in which case it is time for the journey to move on. So here she's talking about the purification process. She's saying that as long as we are still being triggered, that's what she means by having these responses, we need to live the responses. That's the same as what Michael Singer would talk about, opening up the heart and letting the emotions move through. It's what we call rest, accept, and trust. So she's saying you have to live these responses, live through all of these responses until basically they are no longer there. Until, she says, until they no longer provide the slightest challenge. This is what many people would call inner peace. But then she says, when you get here, it's time for the journey to now move on. So the inner peace is the kind of the end of one phase of the journey, but it's really the beginning of this more intense stage of the journey, where you prepare to let go of life itself, as the way they're describing it. She says the mysterious experience of dying was actually, I find those words very, very interesting, because, you know, it wasn't physical death, because we have a body sitting here writing and talking about the death as a memory, right? And that's important to remember too, I think, if this experience comes upon us. It's important to remember that there were those who survived this death and were able to talk about it. Because, of course, the ego is going to scream that there's no survival, that we need to back out, right? But here she says, the mysterious experience of dying was actually, so there's something there that can talk about it, right? The mysterious experience of dying was actually a premonition or foreknowledge of something tremendous down the road. So she knew within herself that if she went through this death, there was something beyond it. That was already there. A life wherein there is no awareness or experience of self, be it true self, unknown self, phenomenal self, or even Christ self. No one can imagine a condition ahead of time, because that which imagines such a condition is the self. So she knew that when she went through this death, this what felt like surrendering of life itself, that there would be something tremendous, she called it. She knew there would be something tremendous on the other side, but that there would be no self of any type. All right? So in that way, it is a death. It is a death of the sense of self. But again, there's still something here writing this book, right? She says, the dilemma or mystery, however, was how there could be any awareness of God if there was no one left to be aware of God. Furthermore, if there is no awareness of self or God, then how can there be any awareness of anything at all? And I know these are the kinds of questions that have entered y'all's minds too. I've seen especially Manuela writing about this, you know. And so these are the kinds of thoughts that I'm sure were entering her mind with a bit of fear. Like, if I go through this needle, this final doorway, if I go through this, you know, I know there's going to be no self. There's going to be no self to be aware of God, have a divine relationship. So, you know, what is that? You know, and you can imagine how that really feels like a death. It's a death of everything you could possibly know. She says, I did not see how one could get around the world with no awareness, right? How's the body going to survive? And she had, I think, 4 kids. How am I going to take care of my kids? You know, she says, right here, I felt my entire life with God had finally been brought to bear on this single point or fine line between self and no self. And then listen to this sentence. To flinch would have been a lack of trust and love. You hear that? She was just being as still as possible while all this was going on with her. To flinch would have been a lack of trust and love. If trust is perfect, there is no movement. And in this stillness, our existence hangs in the balance. To exist or not to exist, the choice is ours. And of course, exist means return to the self, right? Return to the I am presence, return to the illusion. But she's very aware that she gets to make this choice. To exist or not to exist, the choice is ours. She says, nor can anyone know ahead of time what lies beyond this line. Because the line is the boundary of consciousness beyond which consciousness cannot go. Of course, she's talking about moving from the second principle of God to the first principle of God. So all of this awareness that if I make this choice and I go, I have no idea what I'm going into. I mean, absolute, complete unknown. She says, for this reason, consciousness is incapable of imagining life beyond its own existence. Nor can consciousness of its own accord pass over the line or put an end to itself. Only the divine can do away with the human boundaries. Man has no say whatsoever. And that's also what Jesus said, right? For man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. It's what the Course says, that God takes the last step. She says, the moment the line dissolves is unknown. It happens in great stillness and is not an experience. So that's an interesting thing. I don't think we can even imagine what she means by that, right? The moment that you pass through that final doorway, it happens in great stillness and is not an experience. You can't really point to it and say, that's where I went through, right? Imagine that. Because everything that maybe would have been able to point has now dissolved. No event could be less spectacular or more momentous, right? It can be less spectacular and it couldn't be more, you know, more grand. In the strict sense, this event is not a milestone of the journey. Instead, it is the true end of the journey. The events beyond this line are not meant for this world and have nothing to do with it. She says, what characterizes the no-self condition is the knowledge of the ultimate truth. What characterizes the no-self condition is the knowledge of the ultimate truth. If, following this event, the particular destiny is not to remain in this world, then man dies a physical death and moves directly to his ultimate destiny. But if one is destined to remain in this world, The senses must go through the ordeal of staying awake to this world without self or consciousness. Few people realize what a difficult feat it is for the senses to stay awake without consciousness or without the experience of a functioning mind and experience of self. And this, of course, we've heard people talk about going through a process of maturing, of adjusting to awakening. And I'm sure this is what they're talking about, right? If the body remains, the body now has to learn to get along without a self. And that process is completely different than living with a body was before. And so there's an adjustment period that happens. About a week after the line dissolved, when the mind deliberately tried to look within, instantly the divine center quietly exploded and vanished. The sensation was a sudden drop. After this, it is never again possible to look within. Not only will the mind no longer function in this reflexive manner, but without a center, there is no within anymore. And without a within, there is no vessel to experience any emptiness. Simply put, there is nothing left to be empty. Without this unitive center, there is no experience of life, being, or existence, nor any of the movements and feelings to which this center gives rise. No experience of life, being, or existence. That would be what we often call the I am, right? The I am is no longer there. There's no experience of the I am. She says, the divine is beyond all that man calls awareness or consciousness. Divine knowing is something else entirely. It cannot be known or grasped by mind, and it is not an experience. She goes, it's a mystery in which the divine is not even aware of itself. Initially, life with the senses only is spectacular and indescribable. It might be compared to seeing the universe in ecstasy. Everything glows with the brilliance and marvel of God. So, you know, these are really curious words because, again, she talks about there being no life. She talks about there being no being. She talks about the divine is not even aware of itself. And then she turns right around and talks about seeing through the senses without consciousness and how that is ecstasy. Everything glows with the brilliance and marvel of God. Though the sensory eyes see what everyone normally sees, the eye that beholds this vision is not of the senses, mind, or consciousness. Rather, this eye was over the top of my head and outside of the body completely. So this is interesting too, because she says that the body's eyes saw the same thing everybody else saw. So in other words, at one level, perception is still happening, but it's the body that is seeing. It's the body that's perceiving, not I, right? I am seeing something entirely different. And if you pay attention to Nisargadatta, he talks about this, right? He talks, it's almost like two kinds of seeing are happening at the same time. There's the body, which has somehow learned to get by without consciousness, and it sees the same thing everybody else sees. It knows what a tree is, right? It knows what an an is and what a ron is, etc. But that's the body seeing. That's not me or I seeing. Because I am now the absolute, and what I see is entirely different. It's not the same as what the body sees. She says this type of seeing, this experience of two sights almost, this type of seeing lasted for a full 9 months when abruptly one day the light over the head disappeared. The picture now was of a dead, lifeless, almost stony universe. Virtually a universe void of God. In this void of voids, I knew firsthand that a condition does indeed exist that matches our notions of hell. And sometimes you'll hear people talking about passing through this void, right? So she's experiencing this void now where there doesn't seem to be life anywhere. She said this void of voids endured for about 4 months. There is no self to feel frightened, however, no self to feel anxious or trusting or hopeful. There is nothing around but a complete void of voids. The void of voids is absolute because there is nothing beyond it. This is the experience, not the truth, because she goes on to talk about what's beyond it. When you're in the void, this is the experience. There is nothing beyond it, nothing above it, nothing behind it, nothing emerging from it. The void of voids is all that exists. That which remains or exists when there is no self or no consciousness. The void of voids means that form itself is void or the void. Form is not other than the void. So what she's really describing is all of our lives, as we look at each other, we think we're seeing life. I look at Francine and I think I'm seeing a living being. This is where the realization strikes that that's not true. And we read over and over again in these quotes and in A Course in Miracles that there is no life in the body, right? And so now she is seeing that, that there is no life in the body. There is no life in the world. She says it does not emerge from something or give way to something. There is nothing beyond it, above it, or behind it. There is nothing besides it. Form then is void, and the void is form. There is no distinction possible. Then she says this dawning came about in what I have called a smile of recognition, which unfortunately is not an apt description. There comes a point when anything we say is not it. It is because anything we say fails to convey the absolute truth. But what happened is she came to see beyond the void to what she calls eternal form. She says eternal form is not apart from what we see, yet it is also not what we see. In order to come upon eternal form, all form must first be an absolute void where nothing can be, where nothing can possibly, nothing can be. It is only from this position that eternal form can be revealed. She says, eternal form is the all and everywhere of the divine, which means we cannot point to any single form and say, there is the divine, or point to any person and say, he or she is divine, nor can we refer to any experience and say, this is the divine. And that sounds a lot like something Jesus said, right? You can't say that the kingdom of God is here or the kingdom of God is there, right? And she's kind of saying the same thing. It's the all and the everywhere, but it's no single thing. She says, God as eternal form is everywhere. It is one absolute eternal form. After the smile of recognition, the void of voids lifted and was never encountered again. So that's important to know too, right? That this void is a temporary passing through. She says, altogether, however, it took 2 to 3 years to finally acclimate to the no-self condition or the dimension of living. This acclimation consists of the senses having to stay awake and remain functional without any self or consciousness. She says the tendency was for the senses to continually fall into the great silence. So it sounds like what she's talking about is she would fall into what the Indians call samadhi, right? Just fall into that and it's funny, I'm saying she, but she's saying there's no self and no consciousness there. But what had to be learned was for the senses to stay outward and aware of the world, even though there was no consciousness there to push attention outward. She says, while the unitive state is indeed man's true mature state in the world, and by the unitive state, she is referring to awakening to consciousness, or what I call awakening to the second principle of God, or what Nisargadatta would call awakening to the I am presence, right? She says, while the unitive state is indeed man's true mature state in this world, the no self condition is not compatible or even integrable with the human condition. And this is what Michael Langford always says. He says that the absolute is not human at all. And that's what she's saying. The highest that a human can attain is awakening to the I am presence. When you awaken beyond the I am presence, there is nothing human left. She says the resurrected, she calls it the resurrected condition, because remember, she's a Catholic, so she uses Christian language. She says the resurrected condition is incapable of true involvement in this world. As said before, its sole purpose is to affirm the ultimate truth. About 6 months after the above events, I wrote The Experience of No Self, which is another one of her books. Perhaps 3 or 4 years after the falling away of a self, there occurred a further disclosure. So it's kind of interesting how this process kind of seems to continue to unfold a little bit. After communion one morning, the body seemingly began to inhale, though it did not come from the outside, what I can only describe as a type of odorless anesthetic, kind of reminiscent of ether, that instantly spread from the lungs to the entire body. It was as if the body had dissolved into this divine air. This condition, however, is incompatible with continued sensory existence or bodily functioning. Like an anesthetic, it closes down the senses at one point. Or it closes down the senses. At one point, the air became so heavy and condensed that continued breathing was all but impossible. If at this moment the air had not thinned, there would be no body remaining to give this account. About all that can be said is that if we put together man's loftiest experiences of ecstasy, bliss, love, and all things ineffable, they fall as short of the divine condition as the size of an ant falls short of that of an elephant. Consciousness's most lofty heavenly experiences of the divine are but a palest shadow of the ultimate divine condition or heaven. And I'll stop there. But I thought that I would share this because we're going through this chapter that's talking about how there is no world, the self does not see a world, et cetera, et cetera. And this is an experience of someone who went through that transition, right? Went through that transition. And she didn't do it in meditation. She did it by living. She meditated sometimes, but it looks like Buddha went through this entire process, probably sitting with his eyes closed. That's the way we have the story. She was still an active living individual. And as an active living individual, she experienced the falling away of the self, the moving in of the void, the moving out of the void, the acclimation period, and then the disappearance of the world, which she says is beyond everything, right? Beyond everything. And if you read Ramana Maharshi, he sometimes talks about what he experiences, he says, is like sleepwalking, right? Now, again, we can't imagine these things, but what's interesting is, first of all, nobody describes it as awful. They all describe it as ecstasy, as bliss, right? As eternal love, joy. And there are people, for lack of better words, who appear extremely trustworthy from all religions and faiths who describe the same experience. So I just wanted to share that with you while we're in this chapter. I wanted to share that there are witnesses to it. And for us to try and imagine it, I think is a waste of our time. You know, it's a waste of our time. It's more about building that trust that she talks about, that there is something beyond this world and that this world is not real. And then if the world is not real, that allows us to start doing some letting go and some surrendering that we would never do if the world was real, because it would be, you know, foolish or sometimes even dangerous. So it allows us to allow our own inner guidance to come and to lead us through this process of letting go of the self in whatever way we will let go of the self, until we get to this point of inner peace, which is really very little self left, no, almost no self at all. And then you enter into this next stage, which is letting go of the world and awakening to the absolute. Yeah, I see Cheryl said, would you describe the void as emptiness? I can't answer that, Cheryl, because it's not my experience. I can only read her words. But I think what it's void of, based on her words, is it's void of life. And the reason it's void of life is it never actually had life in the first place. So it's seeing that. It's seeing that what we thought was life isn't. And the shock of seeing that, probably. Until form completely disappears and what she called eternal form is revealed. Any other comments or questions? Pretty heavy stuff, huh? Yeah, it's heavy stuff because we can't comprehend it. Do you need me to show you her picture again, what a sweet old lady she is?
I had one thought, Regina.
Yeah.
That void, I'm almost thinking that, you know, that's the sleep. You know, in Hindu mythology, the god Indra slept and dreamed of a world out of a lotus flower from his navel, right? And that void is just like the sleep. It's like passing through the sleep before you become awake again. I mean, I don't really have any more words other than that, but the blackness, but it's like not a sleep of a bodily sleep. It's like the universal sleep that consciousness fell into. Like, that is the tiny man idea, or whatever you want to call it. That darkness you pass through is that.
Well, it does absolutely seem to be a transition from the belief that the world is something or that consciousness is something to the realization of the absolute. So it's kind of like you've already left the old way of seeing, and you've not yet fully arrived at the new way of seeing, and you're caught in this middle position for a bit. Right? It's like a transition. So just wanted to share that with you. And that way you'll have that with you as you continue to contemplate some of these quotes. I have then in my notes, read 251 after reading that. So let's look at 251. Absolute existence, the pure sky of grace, free from the sorrow of eye and mind, will be attained when, in the mind that sees as the self and has died in that supreme reality, the imaginary concepts of the world and the physical body have entirely ceased to be, which I think is probably what she is describing at this last point, after this inhaling of this divine air, right? Then all the senses shut down, and she ceased to see a world or a body anymore. And yet, 4 months later, she wrote a book. How can you explain this stuff, right? The only way to really find out what these words are trying to describe is to live it yourself. Absolute existence, the pure sky of grace, free from the sorrow of eye and mind, will be attained when? In the mind that sees as the self and has died in that supreme reality, the imaginary concepts of the world and the physical body have entirely ceased to be. This is what she just described for us. Yes, Jay.
Can I share an experience I had this morning?
Sure.
This was prior to waking up. It was like I was being receiving, like, I guess you could call it a dream state, but it didn't really feel like that. There was like teachings, it's like not a voice, and it didn't feel like another person, but it was reading like Nisargadatta or Ramana, and it was playing in my mind, not audibly. It was like, it's hard to describe, but that went on for a long time. And then I was in this state where I felt like this really clean water was just flowing through me. I don't know how else to describe it. And I was completely without thought. And it was the incredibly divine feeling, and it felt really good. You know, then I quote unquote woke up, and about 10 minutes later, thought returned, unfortunately. but it was just neat being in that thought free state for at least a little while.
Yeah.
And there was nothing feeling lacking at all. I wasn't feeling like I was missing something. It wasn't a negative void. It wasn't anything like that. I was incredibly contented. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't, and it was just amazing. And I just wanted to share that. And I know it's just a passing experience ultimately, but it was really neat. So I just tried.
Well, and I think one thing that's important to say about your experience and Tony's experience while driving that she shared with us last week is notice how you did not bring these experiences on. Right? I mean, I think that's really important to point out. What we can do is our spiritual practice. But we cannot bring on these experiences. And she's even referring to the fact that the human, even though a decision had to be made to exist or not to exist, the human couldn't make that decision. The divine had to. Just like the human was not able to create your mystical experiences, the divine did. So in that way, you have a taste of what she's talking about.
But I also thought that really sucked because I can't create it again.
No, you can't.
I'm totally out of control. I'm like, well, I didn't do anything to create this, nor any practice or technique or anything. I can make this. And I used like a cat analogy, like it's going to come around when it feels like wanting to sit on your lap.
Yes, that's exactly what it's like. It comes around when it wants to. I remember when I had the Apple experience, one guy wrote to me and asked me if I could meditate and become a piece of celery. Like, no, I didn't become the apple. I can't become a piece of celery. You know, so again, it isn't the little self that does this stuff. The little self does do the spiritual practice. But the mystical experiences, the thought-free state, the awakening happens. Right? It happens. It's not something that you can actually do, which is quite interesting. And again, let me just, because that was pretty weird, let me read this last paragraph again. Let's see. Because it is weird to the mind. I mean, if your mind is saying it's weird, I understand, because it is weird to the mind. Right? The mind can't imagine what she's talking about. So what the mind does is judge against it. But listen to this last paragraph. She says, as for this divine air, no word enters the mind. It simply puts an end to the mind. So this is what Michael Langford would call Manonasa. About all that can be said is that if we put together man's loftiest experiences of ecstasy, bliss, love, and all the things ineffable, they fall as short of the divine condition as the size of an ant falls short of that of an elephant. Consciousness's most lofty heavenly experiences of the divine are but a palest shadow of the ultimate divine condition or heaven. And that's what they all say, right? So even though the mind is saying, that doesn't sound like something I want, the witnesses are saying, you can't even imagine how fantastic this is. And it's permanent. I mean, she goes on to talk about she doesn't like using the word condition because condition implies a passing state. However, this is permanent. She just, you know, has to use words. I don't know where to go from here. I have a lot of stuff and not enough time. So I'm in it sitting here thinking, huh, where should I go? I don't remember what Andy's was, so let's go there. It says read 259 and look at Andy's journal. So let's read 259 and we'll go look at Andy's journal. It says that which is spoken of life itself is the true life. The other life is merely the body. Oh, by the way, do these words have slightly more meaning now? Right, remember? She said that what was happening was this dying. She had to give up life. She had to give up existence. And then there was this void where she saw that the form was just a void and the void was the form. And notice this other life is merely the body. In other words, this is implying that isn't real life. What we experience as life is not life. Imagine that. That there's actually a capital L life, which is so much more than what we experience as life. You know, imagine you're for me, it would be out in nature on a beautiful sunny day, you know, out among the beauty of La Vida, for example, on a beautiful sunny day, and just how free and clear and alive everything is. And they're saying that's not life. That doesn't compare to life. Right? Imagine that. So that which is spoken of as the life of life itself is the true life. That other life is merely the body. That illusory knowledge mediated by the senses is nothing but delusion. The pure consciousness that underlies it alone is true consciousness. And by pure consciousness, they're referring to what she called eternal form. You know, people are using different words here. But I said I wanted to go look at what Andy wrote, so let's go have a peek at this. I really don't remember it, so I'm kind of curious myself. Did I pass him? I must have. Try this again. Oh, there he is. Yeah, he was right there at the top. I went right past him. Okay. And this is 259. All right. He says, it would be so much easier to bypass the illusion if it were not for the senses, which are continually bombarding and overpowering the you with information about the illusion. Then, as the sensory information comes in, thoughts are generated in turn. This whole illusion is sustained by your belief in a you, your attention on the information coming in from those senses, followed by the associated subsequent thoughts generated by the mind. This line I thought was really important. The senses are there to sustain the illusion. Everything that your eyes see, your fingers feel, your ears hear, etc., are part of the feedback loop to create the appearance of a subject and objects which make this whole show seem real. But then I really love this part. But you can use those senses to your advantage. You can use them as a first step to get you into the here and now and reel you in from thoughts, especially thoughts regarding the past or the future. This step can bring you into the present moment to focus you on whatever is arising right here and now, right in front of you. As you turn away from thought and towards your present senses, the next step is to reel in even further by remaining in the stillness, beingness, timelessness, and let your sensory experiences go. In the same way that you used your senses to go out into the world to play in the illusion and stimulate thought, you can use your senses in the opposite direction as a midpoint to reel your awareness or attention back inward, away from the world and thoughts, and then, once there, in turn, go beyond even the delusion of senses to complete the focusing on self and just abiding in pure, underlying consciousness, stillness, being, right? And I want to point out again, here he's talking about abiding in consciousness, stillness, being, which is the goal, because the goal is to awaken to the I Am presence, to awaken to the unitive consciousness state, right? It's later that the second awakening occurs to the absolute. But right now, most of us, if not each of us, are focused on awakening to the I Am presence first, the consciousness state. So again, he's talking about the senses. Believing the senses is what keeps us stuck in this world and this belief that I'm a person. But if I just pause and kind of just listen to the sounds instead of thinking, or feel the sensations in the body, and then start focusing on what's aware of this sensation or what's aware of this sound, right, and turn my attention inward, then the senses become a tool for focusing on the beingness or the I Am presence, a tool for awakening. So I just thought that was really a lovely sharing. I wanted to share that. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Let's see. Let's look at 261 then. If I am to affirm who I am, my true nature, I am the self that knows nothing of the fleshly body, life, intelligence, and mind, that is free of all darkness, the true I that excels as pure consciousness. And again, we just heard her describe the process that gets to this state. It's interesting that Ramana Maharshi and his followers call this state the self, and she called it the no self. But they're referring to the exact same thing, which again, you can't let words confuse you. But the way you know they're referring to the exact same thing is because of the description. Knows nothing of the fleshly body, nothing of life, right? She said that, remember? Although we can't imagine that, she said that. Knows nothing of life, nothing of intelligence, nothing of mind. So different words, but describing the exact same state. But what I have here in my notes is to look at the RDA journal for 261. So let me share the screen again and we'll do that. To say, I, the person, am aware of I, the self, is like saying, I, the Halloween costume, am aware of I, the person. Such a statement is evidence of misplaced identity. So I think the reason I wanted to share this is because, we had a quote earlier about how one person describes their experience with language, and another person hears that language in their imagination and imagines that they understand. And I think that that is what can happen as we're reading these quotes, that we actually can't understand. And so when people begin to imagine they know what this is talking about, and if they can then imagine that they're experiencing that state when they aren't, and that's kind of like saying, I, the person, am aware of I, the self. It's impossible for I, the person, to be aware of I, the self. Just like it's impossible for a Halloween costume to be aware of the person, right? It's impossible. So it's much better just to be genuine and realize that we are still having the human experience, which means we are not aware of the self. We are not aware of the absolute, right? She even said in what I just read that what a human calls awareness isn't even what awareness actually is. And if we look at 262 quickly, oh, that's a long one. We can't look at 262 quickly. That's impossible. What else did I have here? 264, we could probably look at it quickly and then end with that. So 264 says, there are dream consequences for the bad acts committed in the dream. And while you still take the dream to be reality, you will suffer the consequences of your bad behavior. Do no evil and have no hate. Have equanimity towards everything. And so my journal is talking about how while the mind-body-world illusion persists, there will be temptations. Every temptation comes from the belief that the mind-body-world are reality. And to believe illusion as if it is reality is the cause of suffering. Do not deny the pull of temptation when it was present. And that could be the temptation to yell at someone, for example, for being stupid, in your opinion, right? Do not deny the pull of temptation when it is present, but do regain some sense of sanity. Check with your heart, practice self-inquiry, move to awareness of core present being. True spiritual practice removes every temptation and sets you free from the mind-made illusion of suffering. So I think the reason I wanted to bring you there is to point out that the quote really isn't just talking about behavior. You know, if you misunderstood the quote to be talking about behavior, for example, if you really wanted to scream at someone and you just bit your tongue and didn't do it because you don't want bad karma, but all that energy is still moving on in you. Your mind is still chattering about it. You're still upset about it. In effect, you're still going to initiate the karma. That what you need to do with it is spiritual practice, right? What you need to do with that energy is practice inquiry, practice root cause analysis, practice rest, accept, and trust. It's what the Course calls practice forgiveness. So as we're reading this more lofty stuff about there is no world, don't forget about the basic practices, because they are still very, very important, because we are still living the human state. And to be absolutely honest, we still think the world is real and we will suffer our karma at this point, right? So use every experience for the practice of forgiveness, just like we're back in year one. Use every experience to release false beliefs, to release judgments, to release desires, release attachments. Don't forget the basics. They're still extremely important. All right, that's it, guys. Now, next week, I will be here. Next week, I will be here. 2 weeks from now, I won't be, and Shauna will take over. But next week, I will be here. So I will see you all next week, okay? Bye.